America's Got Talent. So does Britain, Pakistan, Nigeria, Greece, Vietnam, Sweden, Slovakia, and a number of other countries in on the Got Talent, Idol, or X Factor franchises of reality TV talent shows. As Meg Wolitzer put it in an essay for the Financial Times, regardless of your locale, at some point you will be confronted with a fetching, trembling little girl with a voice that's powerful enough to shatter your eardrums while still tender enough to break your frozen heart. Wolitzer is author of many books, including most recently The Interestings. Her essay, In Search of the Real Thing, is a meditation on how our culture has come to equate talent with success.
I think that what's happened in our culture is that it really has become harder to separate out talent from success, especially since the internet was created, and there's this kind of excitement that ripples through everybody, like in a morning. If you go on Twitter or go on Facebook or just go to various sites, you sort of learn what people are excited about. And sometimes they're excited about the excitement, which is, you know, why I brought up Susan Boyle. I had looked at a clip of when she first sang, and they showed kind of the open-mouthed excitement of the listeners in the audience who couldn't believe that this plain-looking woman could sing in such a powerful way. And what actually became important was not the quality of the singing or how good it really was, after all, but the fact that it was a sort of surprise success. And I think, especially in America, we love success. We love success stories. We love it when people win a lot of money or get really big. And that's where a lot of the emphasis has gone.
When you stood there with that cheeky grin and said, I want to be like Elaine Page, everyone was laughing at you. No one is laughing now.
If it is success that draws us, why then are audiences globally captivated by shows like America's Got Talent and American Idol when we seem to love discovering raw talent?
Well, we love discovering it, but I think it's what happens afterward that we really are interested in, how that person is sort of taken from obscurity and given money and fame. We love to follow the journey of that because we see ourselves in it. I mean, I think that there's this notion that's rather false, that anyone can just sort of become talented in some way, that if you work really hard, you can become brilliantly talented at something, and it's very, very rare to become that talented at something. But we have a fantasy that it could happen to us. But I think what we're fantasizing about is not the possession of the pure talent in and of itself, but what might happen to us if it were discovered that we were so special. And that's the thing. I mean, I think talent, sort of taken out of its context, sometimes isn't recognized. I talk in the piece, actually, about a kind of famous perception experiment that was done by Joshua Bell, the world-famous violinist. Mm-hmm. He went into the Metro in Washington, D.C.
on a busy Monday morning, I think it was.
Busy Monday morning, right. And he played six pieces, and he's one of the best violinists in the world. And as he played, people just ran through, walked through, went to their trains, went to work, occasionally stopped for about a second and maybe thought, oh, wow, he's kind of good, and then moved on. He really got barely a notice, whereas, you know, people buy scalped tickets to go see him around the world. He's a really brilliant violinist who music people know is one of the best. And yet, out of that context, out of the Sydney Opera Hall, Music Hall, out of wherever he plays around the world, the Philharmonic, he is just sort of seen as another busker. And how can that be? Do we really not see it? Do we need the trappings of absolute greatness to know?
You spend some time in this essay kind of tracing the relationship between talent and success. Have they always gone hand in hand?
I was looking back to my own experience, really, growing up as a writer and sort of coming to New York and trying to make it. And all my friends were sort of trying to make it as writers. And, you know, I think back then we just cared about being allowed to do our work. And even actually going back a little earlier than that, looking at the childhoods of most of the people I know who ended up living and working as writers, because many of my friends are writers, there was a time when we just sort of loved doing what we did. We would write something, we'd write a ridiculous, terrible play that we made our parents watch, We wrote short stories. We wrote novels at age 11. We did art. We did all kinds of things. And it was not about, of course, will I make a living from it, nor was it about will I win a MacArthur or a National Book Award. It was really about will I be able to do this thing that I love. But, of course, being a child has nothing to do with the rigors of what happens when you get older and want to be an artist or do something talent-based for a career. So even back in the 80s, when I came to New York and had sold my first novel for $5,000, which I thought was going to last me for, you know, a decade or so, I and my friends lived in little apartments. We had a lot of cheap takeout Indian food at night. A couple of us were selling novels. And we just sort of, we weren't competitive. We were just kind of going along. And slowly, I think, you know, I traced the changes in the 80s and the Reagan era and the way money sort of took over and art now became quite often about commerce. I mean, this is the era then that of the big Julian Schnabel paintings and, you know, the Mary Boone Gallery and all kinds of stuff cropping up in New York that was about investors and about money. And then there were novelists who were making a lot of money, and suddenly you'd take your own pulse and say, well, I thought it was pretty great that I sold my novel for $5,000, but is it great enough? Because this one is now on the cover of a magazine. I think that it really infiltrated even the kind of modest world of the kind of art that the people I knew were doing.
At that time, being in New York was the place to be if you were a writer or if you were a painter. For many different reasons, that was where the purveyors of taste were located. Now we're living in this era where, you know, everybody can make themselves famous on the internet. They can publish their stories on the internet or their paintings on the internet. And how many people can actually afford a New York apartment anymore if they don't have a good job writing?
New York was taken over by the rich. I think the internet is an interesting case because it was sort of meant to, among other things, be a place where we would discover all kinds of talent that we hadn't seen before. It would be brought to the fore. And of course, there are examples of that, but I think they're few and far between. A lot of what you see on the internet is not so much better or sometimes worse, you know, than what you've always seen when you've sought it out. So real, real talent is as rare as it ever was.
You're reminding me of a success maybe overriding talent. I'm thinking of Miley Cyrus. I mean, you probably heard her song, Wrecking Ball. So regardless of whether you think that she's talented or not, it's not even about the quality of the song. The discussion now is whether she's in the middle of a breakdown. And even when you consider her pretty much gobsmacking appearance at the VMAs, it is considered a success because everybody Googled it the next day.
Right.
So, Meg, have talent and success become unhinged?
There are people who love certain artists and love books and are passionate about them. This is a pluralistic society in terms of what we love. So you can go and find people who are obsessed with an obscure Flemish painter and want to talk about it. But if you're looking for agreement across the board, then you really are probably talking about success more than you're talking about talent. I tend to think that the whole thing starts to feel kind of like a big novel, that that's what the internet does. It creates this narrative about a person. Is she having a breakdown? Is she good? Is she racist? And I think that everybody feels like they are able to weigh in, and that sort of democratization is a relatively new thing. There was never a platform for it before. But if you look closely, if you look in certain quarters, you will find people who do love and respect talent. But you may not see it in the most obvious, big, glaring places. That's like staring at a billboard and saying, is that really telling me the truth? You know, you like to think that that expression, talent will out, is true. But I guess what really you have to take into account is the idea that obscurity and fame are relative words. Does it mean something if you sell your novel and you get a wonderful review and 5,000 people buy it? Are you a success or are you just a terrible failure? The internet has changed the terms and has made almost everything seem like a failure unless you have mass approval. And since when have most of the best artists been loved by everyone? I mean, the thing about talent is that a lot of it is controversial. People hate it, don't want to buy it. Sometimes you don't sell a lot of copies and only you have some diehard fans, but you can't use the internet as a mirror of whether you're really talented.
Meg Wolitzer, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
The talented Meg Wolitzer is author of The Wife, The 10-Year Nap, and other books, most recently The Interestings. You can read her essay on talent that she wrote for the Financial Times. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think. Is it harder to see talent nowadays than it was back when Ed Sullivan was showcasing it on TV? Have YouTube and other social media changed the way you recognize or appreciate talent? If you're a musician or writer, do you worry that it's impossible to get recognized in such a glut of talent? Share your thoughts on our Facebook page or on Twitter.